Hello and welcome to the White Ball Rugby Podcast. And once again, once more, over and over
unto
again,
the breach, dear friends. Once more, unto the breach, dear friends. Carry on.
It is, of course, Sam Roberts. Sam, how are you?
I'm not too bad. The weeks are whistling by, aren't they? And rugby is filling our calendar in all sorts of different ways. Had a good session. Personal plug. Had a very, very good evening with Sarah Hunter last night. If you managed to follow me on my social media trail, that will be coming out. I'll be putting out that whole interview that we did last night. Fascinating insight into a sporting goddess, shall we call her, you know, absolutely extraordinary career, brilliant insight. And then, of course, part of Red Roses and that whole thing. She's about to have a baby. She's kind of still involved, and she had to go home last night. She said, I'm going to have to, you know, leave at 9:30. I said, oh, of course, you know, eight and a half months pregnant, or however big she is. And I said, yeah, of course, got to get you home. She said, no, I've got a call with Canada at 11. So she was still on the phone, still working hard, working with the Red Roses team out in Canada. And fascinating individual. So, yeah, really, really lucky to do that last night. Very, very nice. And we'll talk about the Red Roses. We'll talk about WXB, shall we?
Yes, we will. Yeah, well, we're going to talk about a bit about finances, a bit about WXV, a bit about rugby sur le continent. And then that'll be our half hour, Sam.
Easily.
Which of those do you want to kick off with?
I think, should we stay with WXV? I think that probably seems a logical place to go. We've mentioned Sarah Hunter there. We mentioned the women's game. It's in fine form at the moment, the women's game. And from an England perspective, obviously they are sailing very, very well. And I suppose what's interesting for me for this competition is just to see how well other teams can try and match the way that England have dominated things. And I was really pleased. Ireland, great performance last weekend to beat New Zealand last weekend. And I'm really interested to see the response that we get from teams like Canada, who will have a point to prove. Obviously, USA roundly pumped last week by England. I think Canada will definitely be a team in that top tier. Canada, Ireland and England. We need to see something from them as we start this countdown to the World Cup next year. I think that's going to be really, really interesting. So, what are you seeing? What bits are you picking out, especially from Tier One?
Yeah, I think it's a really fascinating setup because it reminds me a little bit of there hasn't been a cycling reference on this podcast for a while now, so forgive me this one, but it reminds me a little bit of kind of 2008 when teams realized in the velodrome that you could, if you just outspent, you could win medals. And there was this arms race to spend as much as possible. And I do feel there's an element of that in the women's game, which is quite exciting, especially if you're the player, of teams realizing, you know, Ireland in 2 years, actually in 1.5 years, have gone from, you know, dreadful in the Six Nations to beating New Zealand. And that has come about because they are spending money, they're prioritizing the professional kind of tiers and working their way through that professional development. And you realize that this isn't a thing that's going to take 5 years. This is a thing that's happening in, you know, more or less 18 months. And I do think there's a huge opportunity there for teams to realize, well, actually, if we just pump a bit more cash in here, you know, you see where Ireland came from last year. They were in WXV 3, and I believe, and won that. And now here they are beating New Zealand. So there's a huge potential there.
To clarify, you don't just mean, you know, Wolf of Wall Street, throw money at it. It's about investing in the right things, but in the right way. And I think that's what you're seeing. And what you're talking about there is Ireland going about it and spending money on the right things in the right way to allow those players to develop. Because what money sometimes gives you is time. You know, you get people on professional contracts, which means that you spend more time in camp and you spend more time with people. And lo and behold, more time means better quality learning and better quality development and all of that that goes with it. So just in case anyone was listening to that and thinking, you know, that the process is just to throw, you know, Jordan Belfort at, you know, money at it. It's not quite like that, but I get what you're saying in a sense.
Yeah.
Question for you about England. And I kind of asked Sarah Hunter this last night. It's a difficult place they find themselves in a sense that they are by far and away the best team. And so everyone is already starting to talk about the fact that, you know, in 12 months' time, it is almost a fait accompli that they win the World Cup. That's a difficult place to be because, you know, to be a great team, you've got to find, you know, your own galvanization. I don't think that's quite a word, but you've got to find your own impulses, your own drivers. And when people place you at the top and say, well, basically you're the guys at the top, where do you find the chip on your shoulder? Where do you find that bit of grit that you need to continue to be brilliant? So what would you be saying, or how would you be talking to the Red Roses about what they need to do over the next 12 months?
Yeah, I think it's really tough, as you say, because, you know, there will be internal discussions, I reckon, of players constantly being reminded that it's not a done deal. They need to put the effort in. They need to make everything. Yeah, they need to just make sure that everything's perfect. If it's not perfect, they won't win. There will be a lot of that conversation going on. However, and also you only have to look back at the last World Cup to realize that, you know, they aren't guaranteed to win. However, realistically, it's a little bit like the Rugby League World Cup in that you know Australia's going to be there. They're going to be in the final. You're just not sure who they're going to play. And I think that's the same with England. England will definitely make the final. I would bet, you know, a large amount on that. The big challenge is how successful will they be along the way? Because, you know, it's not just about winning, but it's about, I think they'll really want to put a marker down. They'll want to put some big scores on. And I think that can be a self-powering kind of cycle in that you don't just want to beat the US, you want to put 60 points on them. And so I think there's going to be a lot more of that from England in that they won't just be happy if they beat a team by 10 points. It will be if they really kind of put them to the sword.
Sarah Hunter said something interesting to me last night. She said, we are trying to cover all eventualities. Remember that last World Cup, you know, red cards, yellow cards, coming down to 13 players, 12 players. You know, they are now trying to cover all eventualities. You know, they're now thinking, okay, yeah, we're in a really good position, but what if this happens? What if that happens? And I wonder whether or not these sort of games will see Mitchell and co and his coaches really trying to work on every eventuality, because sport is funny. However much Mike Tyson said very, very well, you can have the greatest plan in the world and it goes out the window as soon as you get punched in the face. That's what England have got to be guarding against. The weird way that sometimes rugby does something strange to them. And if you look at teams like Ireland and you look at teams like Canada, something strange happens in a game. Ireland could end up finding themselves with the momentum to beat England. There's no two ways about it. Same with the Black Ferns, same with Canada. Yes, you know, eight and a half times out of 10, England are going to beat them. But in sport, there's always that chance. And that's where they've got to guard. That's what they've got to guard themselves against. I would just want to mention in the second tier as well about Scotland. I'm really, really interested to see whether they can redo what they did last year. You know, reprint the money, as it were. Big fan of McBanahan. We'll have to get him on the pod because he's a great man. Fantastic, fantastic individual, going great guns with them. And then, of course, South Africa hosting. You're going to expect, a little bit like Canada, you're going to expect the host to have something. So the tier two side of things is interesting as well. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I think it's going to be fascinating to see where that goes. I think Wales will be really disappointed with their performance against Australia. Obviously, they beat them at Newport a couple of weeks before WXV began, and they were quite handily beating in Cape Town last weekend. I think Scotland, obviously, they beat Italy 19-0, very comfortable. They played Japan, who I would expect that they will beat. The big marker will be, can they beat Australia? I think that will be, you know, the huge challenge, and it will be a benchmark, not just if they beat them, but if they're close, I think that will be a real encouragement there. And also, we've got potentially such an exciting Six Nations coming up with Wales on the up, qualified on the up, Ireland definitely on the up, Scotland on the up, England is as good as they ever are, and then France potentially looking a little bit shaky, and also Italy had a decent tournament last time out. So I think there might be a couple of, I think England and Italy might kind of bookend it, but those, that movement in the middle, I think is going to be fascinating.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. Let's talk about finances. I've put it off for as long as I possibly can. Tell us what you have been taught, who you've been talking to, and what you've sort of discovered as regards rugby and its finances. Is it as bleak as potentially it seems?
So I don't think it is as bleak as it seems. I've actually crossed the Rubicon to look at football, because we often hear about, we saw the report out, I think last week, about how much debt the rugby teams are in and what that means. I think it's maybe worthwhile stripping it back to the basics and just kind of talking through what that is. I thought I'd use myself as an example. So if you imagine that I'm a club, what are my income streams? And for me, it would be, a wage, and it might, maybe my aunt gives me 10 quid at Christmas, that kind of thing. Yeah, that's my incoming. For rugby teams, you've obviously got the ticket sales, you've got sponsorship, you've got TV deals, and you may have a very small amount of prize money coming in as well. And then you've got your expenditure, which obviously for the normal person is all the stuff, shopping, bills, tax, whatever it might be. For the club, obviously it's players, it's doing the pitch, it's paying staff, it's all that kind of stuff. And what you ideally obviously want is you want on those levels for that to be a profit. And most humans, I would say, would potentially, or you obviously aim to end the year with slightly more than you started the year. However, there in a lot of clubs, I mean, for a lot of people, there's an enormous amount of debt hanging over the top of them. So obviously in my case, I've got a mortgage, which is currently kind of 2.5 times what my income is. So I have an enormous amount of debt hanging over me, yet I am a profitable business at the core of it. And I think that there's quite a lot of that's going on with clubs, where we are seeing, clubs are never going to make enormous profits because there's not really much value in doing that. You'll get taxed on them. You may as well put the profit back into the club, either paying off your debt, signing a player that might increase revenue, or doing up the pitch, or whatever it might be, putting more hospitality boxes in, things that will lead you to continue to be profitable in the future, but would not allow you to be profitable this particular season. So I think in terms of optimism, what we're seeing there is that there is not, so there's debt. There's debt from stadiums, and there's debt from COVID loans and things like that. But actually, there's also a lot of money being made in these teams. And if you strip it back a little bit, I've heard a lot of people say rugby is not, it's just not financially viable. Well, ultimately, it is. There's 10 teams in the Premiership. 8 of them get attendances of over 10,000 per week. There's a lot of money in that. There's TV deals are not as good as they once were, but there is money in those. Sponsorship is probably not as good as it once was, but again, there is money in that. So we're talking about a lot of money being pumped into clubs. And so what needs to be done is the cloth needs to be cut accordingly. But I don't think you can say that they are not financially viable. Perhaps they're not financially viable if you were to pay what you were in the past. But if you were to pay what you could in the future, then they certainly would become financially viable. And if I just have a look at football, so in the Premier League, where there's 20 clubs, 17 of them in 2022 to 2023 made a loss. The only ones who didn't were Manchester City, Brighton and Bournemouth. Everyone else was making a loss there. And actually, Manchester City the year before made a £100 million loss. And in the terms of debt, so again, all bar two are in debt in the Premier League, and no one would look at Man City. Or actually, let's take say Chelsea, who are in around £90 million worth of debt, and say they are not financially viable.
No, I get where you're coming from. The concern I have here is what you're basically saying is that if a club finds itself in debt to improve its facilities, for instance, to spend a load of money on brand new 20 brand new spanking hospitality boxes, which are going to be sold and therefore going to make money in the long term. Absolutely, completely understand that. It's like mortgaging your house. You know, you buy it for the long term, the benefit that it's going to give you in the long term. I suppose where we've got to pay more attention is on exactly where those crowds are coming. How many people are queuing up for tickets? Can everyone get tickets? Is there much point in building a bigger and more shiny stadium if you don't have people lining up to buy tickets? We're going to talk about Pro de Dirt soon. Van had, you know, people literally not being able to get tickets, which immediately makes you go, right, we're going to spend, you know, 3 million on our stadium because, you know, we want to move from 13,000 to 18,000 because we know that we're going to sell out those tickets and that's going to pay for itself. You know, and again, football's difficult to compare rugby to because football has one big thing in it that rugby definitely doesn't, which is transfers. And clubs can make a lot of money off their talent, you know, which rugby can't do. There's no way that exists within rugby. So that's a difficulty there within that. So, I mean, there's lots of reasons to try and agree with you. I suppose And whilst I do, my worry doesn't completely placate it because I'm concerned as to whether or not numbers are growing. And again, I'm going to put you on the spot here, and I know you won't know the answer to this, but how are numbers, you know, moving in terms of people coming to see the game? I know there are certain clubs who've done phenomenally good getting more and more people in year on year, year on year. Is that those are the things that we need to really look at and hang our hats on in terms of where rugby is. Is the appetite for rugby, you know, increasing? Are there more people looking at it and wanting to be a part of it? And if that's the case, then yes, we can have some short-term debt in terms of that. I know from speaking to people, so for instance, what's interesting is like hospitality is easier to sell than tickets. Have you heard this about rugby? Yeah. So lots of people and lots of businesses will go to hospitality, but the individual buying, spending 25, 30, 35, if we look at one club, over £100 on an individual ticket, that's have we got that bit right? Are we pricing that bit right? Now, of course, economists will say to you, well, surely the only thing that dictates a ticket price is how many you can sell. And obviously then you think of Bath and you think, well, if they are pricing them that high, that must mean that people are buying them. Then they're not just plucking that figure out of the air. It's obviously been thought about and where they are and what they're doing. And, you know, so there's lots of things going on here. I agree with you in a sense that short-term debt is or debt with a plan, should we call it, isn't a bad idea. You reference mortgage. Well, you've got a plan to pay off that mortgage. I mean, it's literally what you have to sign up to get that mortgage. You literally have to sign up to that plan to get to a point in 25 years where you don't have that anymore. So if that's the case, if they can show us the plan and they can show us how they're going to get there, that's the worry that I have, I suppose. Is that fair? Does that make sense?
No, it is fair. I think whenever you see debt, it's concerning because you think, well, that's some money that's got to be found somewhere. I think some of that debt is in the situation. So I think rugby has this uncomfortable relationship with the kind of the sugar daddy owners, which obviously football also has a massive situation like that, which doesn't get talked about quite as much. I read something this week that Roman Abramovich was paying £900,000 a week servicing Chelsea's interest. Back when he was there, which obviously, if you've got someone with pockets of that depth, then it's not such a big deal. And I think you see this a bit with Bristol, where there's a big concern. Well, what happens when Steve Lansdowne, you know, is no longer interested or moves on? And you think, well, there is debt, but it's kind of debt that he's going to just write off. And I would imagine there's a good few other clubs who are in that situation where, yes, they pay a nominal sum to a, you know, kind of sugar daddy owner, but it's in a position where that can just be written off. So I think I am less concerned than you. As to the BAF question, so obviously, yeah, BAF tickets are absolutely astonishingly expensive. And they are getting sold, so they keep getting sellouts. So obviously it is working, it is financially viable. However, you do think that they are pricing out more or less all bar maybe 5% of the rugby watching population. And that's fine if there's people there who are willing to pay that. Is there always going to be people willing to pay that? It's clearly an older crowd. Is there going to be the next generation coming through with either the wherewithal or the ability to pay that?
So I have a very interesting insight into this. I know someone who did an MBA around Bath rugby, and one of the pieces of information that they gleaned, and I'm not 100% sure on this, but I know that it's around this sort of figure. What is the average age of a season ticket holder at Bath rugby?
I would say 50.
I'm pretty certain it's closer to 70, and it might even be in the 70s. Now that, when I saw that, I was like, the point you're making there is, well, where does this go? And people aren't around forever. And I link it to another current situation we have at the moment with Cornish Pirates, with Dickie Evans, who has been phenomenal for Cornish Pirates down there, has done time after time and after time, put his hand in his pocket. His generosity has seemingly known no limits up to now, this season, where he has said, this Christmas, I think I'm going to have to walk away. Now, of course, they aren't alone. There are other people in the sphere around rugby who potentially might step in to plug that gap, but will they plug it in the same way? Will they do the same stuff? Bedford went through it with Jeff Irvine. He's stepped away from the club, and they found other people, not in the same way, not the one person, the one pocket, as it were, a number of different pockets coming in and filling it. So there are ways forward, but you've got to be lucky to find these people who are willing to put their hard-earned money into the sport and support it like it has done, or like they have done and will continue to do. We have to be lucky. Otherwise, of course, what happens is what's happened recently with the likes of Jersey and Wasps and Worcester and London Irish, you know. And what's really sad, of course, is, you know, these guys who put all their money, London Irish is a really key point. You know, they were kept afloat by one chap's real generosity for a huge amount of time. And then he didn't want to do it anymore. And all of a sudden he was a villain and they didn't like him. And oh my God, I can't believe he's not. What's happening here? Why has he stepped away from the club? Well, do you not remember? For the last 10 years, he's basically been paying salaries, you know, out of his own pocket. Do we not remember that? And that's what worries me, is people's perception of these people suddenly be, he's the villain now. You're like, really?
Yeah.
Wow. Just because he doesn't want to pick up the bill every time. People have got funny brains and funny thoughts on how this works. And that's another danger, I suppose.
I think it's a challenge, because I remember this probably, you know, a lot of the stuff that happened in COVID where there were successful businesses that sprung out of COVID. So I'm thinking maybe of, you know, Peloton and some bike brands and people who just did really well from the situation that they found themselves in. What happened, I think, with a few of those is there was a complete naivety that this would continue at the same pace as COVID. So I was chatting to someone in a bike shop the other day, and the bike shop was closing. It was closing this year, but it was kind of stemmed from back in COVID. And they'd essentially been sold kind of, you know, 200 bikes to sell in a small shop in West Yorkshire. and it took them ages to sell them. And by the time they'd sold them, they were basically selling them for less than they brought them for. And there does seem to be a slight naivety there of, you know, there is going to be a limit where everyone who bought a bike isn't going to come back a year later and buying another bike and come back a year later and buying another bike. There's clearly a limit. I do think there's an element of that in rugby where there's a naivety of, oh, well, if we can just reach the next level of eliteness, if we can just, you know, we need a bigger stadium because when we win European Cups year after year after year, we're going to need to fill the stadium. If we haven't filled the stadium now, we're just going to miss out on that revenue. And it does seem like there's an element of that that happens. I'm sure that happens in football as well. You know, you see teams who tumble down the leagues. You see Wrexham who are flying up the leagues. Now they've got an injection of cash. I do think there's a challenge there about, you know, you have to be ambitious, but you also have to have a core sustainable business that can withstand certain turmoil. I think expecting teams to withstand COVID without there being any knock-on effect is also naive, but there has to be a core stability there. And if you've got a club where they're not making enough money and the owner is simply just forking out hand over fist money to pay for wages, fundamentally there's something's gone wrong there with the business. I do think there's a challenge here between is rugby itself financially inviable, or are there certain teams that were themselves unviable financially? In the same way that, you know, selling water is not financially unviable, but yet Thames Water have been able to almost, you know, take themselves to the brink of bankruptcy.
And I think also, lastly on this, the amount of things that are demanding our money and demanding our tickets and demanding our time nowadays, there is just so many options for people. You know, it's a really glib phrase of build it and they shall come. You know, well, yes, but you've also got to market it and get a really good social media strategy and constantly be in at people, reminding them of where you are and what they're doing and how it works and everything. This is not something that just is, well, we'll do this and everyone will be attracted to it, because there is so much attraction in the world at the moment. There are so many things trying to take your eyes, take your mind, your pound out of your wallet, trying to grab hold of you, that it isn't just as simple as let's get a great team and everyone will turn up. It's a little bit more. There's a little bit more than that. And it's a struggle. And we've spoken already on this series of podcasts to people involved in that. You know, Tom Tate, my mind immediately goes to him and how they are trying to do it. Very successful Bristol, very successful on a number of different levels. It has not been without incredible hard work. It hasn't just been about Pat Lamb, choose a really fancy 15 and let's go. It's been everything else that's gone with it. So, yeah, interesting. Very interesting conversation and definitely something to think about. And again, I'll open it up to people listening in. You got any ideas? If you're a professor of economics, please get in contact with the Whiteboard Rugby podcast and tell us the error of our ways. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, it'd be great. I think there's definitely smarter people than us on the economics of it, and we'd love to hear from them. Shall we move across the channel briefly, Sam?
We can. When you say we, I'm afraid you're going to do a lot of the swimming across the channel, and I'm just going to sort of tether myself to you and be dragged across to Pro de Dirt. Come on, tell
I
us.
You're going
to
lather me in large there, Sam.
I am going to lather you in large, but that's for our pay per view podcast that you can pay some money for and watch me. Can you imagine if we got subscribers for that? That would be a weird point in our life where we'd have to make a decision about whether we made money or not. It'd be strange. I don't know.
People like all sorts, Sam. If you've
well, they do. That's what I mean. Anyway, that went weird. Talk to me about Pro de Dirt.
Yeah. So we've reached this point where they've played five matches. They take a week off. So this weekend is a week off. And just I guess as a reminder to everyone, because the Pro de Dirt is so massive, the five matches represents just 1/6 of the season. So well, the Premier League is just a Premiership just getting up and running. The Pro League is kind of well on its way, but actually less far through than the Premiership. So far, the top three are Biarritz, Colomiers, and Béziers. And I would say that Colomiers is a surprise. Biarritz, it's surprising that they're as high as they are. Béziers had a great season last year. But you might know the lack of big, massive names there. So Brieve, who made a lot of signings there, their Courtney Laws home, and then fourth. Grenoble, who were great last season, I think eighth. They've had a difficult stretch of season. Provence, again,
George North's Provence. Yes, should we exactly. refer to them as that? George North's Provence.
I think
Laws
so.
Is Brieve.
Yes, just to make everyone feel at home.
Sam Davis is Grenoble. Come on.
Yeah, George North's Provence, I think, fifth. And Oyonnax, who came down from the top 14 and all the way down in 12th and have had a tough season. Joe Alab's Oyonnax, I guess.
Thank you.
To continue
you.
The naming.
I like that. Joe Alab, yeah. Linked at the moment with England machinations, of course, at the moment as well. Yeah. But we'll see. For me, that I'm glad you mentioned Oyonnax because that is a really good example of how well these leagues as a whole, top 14 and Pro de Deux work. It is no cakewalk whatsoever. Coming down from the top 14 into the Pro de Deux is tough, and Oyonnax are showing just that.
Yeah, so I think they've had a tough start to the season. They played Provence last week and got absolutely battered. So it has been really difficult. In terms of the movement between the leagues, so Stade Niçois, so down in Nice, they have had a difficult start to the season. It might be a long old season for them. They have got one win, so they're tied with Valence Romain and Nevers with one
never
win.
Say never say never. I know.
Exactly.
Can I do that? Never say never. But carry on. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that works this year as well because they are in a difficult spot, but they're potentially on the way up. Stade Niçois have a minus 73 points difference in five games, so it is difficult to see how they turn that around. They'll play Mont-de-Marsan next Friday, and then they've got Aurillac the week after. So those are winnable games. I think if they don't get a win out of either of them, I would be just starting to trim them off the bottom of the table and starting to look at who else might go down there.
Yeah, and as a surprise, anyone you mentioned Colomier there, are they the surprise package? Have they come out of the blocks well?
Yeah, so very surprising. So they've got four wins out of their first five matches. And those have come away, which is a their thing in French rugby, away at Mont-de-Marsan, at home to Aurillac, at home to Valence Romain, and away to Nice. So I guess the big thing to call out there for Colomier is those wins have come against weaker opposition. So Aurillac, back down at the bottom of the table, Valence Romain as well, and Nice, as we know, at the foot. So I would not read too much into that because, that might shift very quickly once they start playing the tougher oppositions. I would expect in the next 5 weeks, so the Pro de Deux season works quite nicely where it kind of is chopped into these blocks, so you can kind of treat them each as just 5 week sprints, I guess, and you can see who's winning each one. I would expect things to settle a little bit more, so I'd expect Grenoble to come up a bit, Provence to come up a bit, Oyonnax to come up a little bit, and maybe that kind of the top, middle, and bottom should sort itself out a little bit. But I guess just a reminder, even after that five-game block, we'll only be a third of the way through the season, so there's still a lot of rugby to play.
There is indeed. Brilliant. Thank you very much for that. That's a good dive into the Pro de Deux. We'll continue to venture back there every so often and see how things are progressing. I love that. Another fantastic episode of the Whiteboard Rugby Podcast, Sam Lana. And who do we have coming our way on Monday?
We have the fantastic Charlie Morgan, who is a journalist, analyst, extraordinaire. I'm sure everyone's heard of him, but if you haven't, he is a person to follow, and he was fascinating. I thought we spoke to him on Monday, and he was excellent.
Yeah, really, really good. Really good insight into how rugby writing has changed. Newspapers have got their own problems, finances. We talked about that. They've got their own issues. They've got things like paywalls and stuff to try and to boost their coffers. But really interesting to see how rugby is changing, morphing. We spoke to him definitely. He's a guy who's used analysis and things like moving GIFs in online sort of pieces and loads of stuff like that. So we spoke to him. Great to chat with him. Do not miss that one. That's out on Monday. Sam Lana, thank you as always. Really, really good to have you with us again. And until next time, this has been the Whiteboard Rugby Podcast.